to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24/7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at prn.fm. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hello, this is Dr. Jack Rasmus, your host for the Alternative Vision Show on the Progressive Radio Network. Alternative Visions interviews guests from grassroots America. The show's topics address the continuing economic and political crises in America. Alternative Visions differs from most radio shows. The focus is not only on understanding the crises, but discussing ideas on what can be done about it. Alternative Visions airs every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. And if you don't catch us live, you can still listen 24/7 on the PRN website. Once again, that's prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, a very happy, healthy 2013. It is January 8th, and we're back. I've been off for a couple of weeks, and it's been nice to take a break, actually, and now I'm really excited to get back and talk about my favorite subject, say it with me, food. And all that food has to do with our health, the environment, and the animals that we choose to not eat. Okay, I wanted to remind you about my nonprofit and my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and I just posted my top 10 real favorite cookbooks. So if you would like to find out which ones those are, you can go to the website. You'll see it right on the front page, and it links to many of the interviews that I've done in 2012 here on the Progressive Radio Network with all kinds of wonderful foodies that have created delicious, healthy, inspiring recipes. Let's move on. I have someone very special here in the studio. It's my friend Linda Long, and she has had a lifelong relationship with the food industry, starting as a waitress and a short order cook at the age of 12 in her parents' truck stop in Pennsylvania, a home economist who taught high school foods in early part of her career and spending a decade in the resort hotel business. Linda has been a committed vegan for over 30 years. I'm going to give her a big round of applause. Yay. Here. 30 years. Okay, well, she's got some great credits, and she's the author of Great Chefs Cook Vegan. And she's got a very brand new baby new book out called Virgin Vegan, and we're going to be talking about that today. Virgin Vegan, the meatless guide to pleasing your palate. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Okay.
It is a little book. It's a tiny book.
it's not that tiny, actually, but it looks like it's packed with all kinds of worthwhile information. So let's talk about this. Okay. You've been a committed vegan for 30 years. Why did you think that the world needed Virgin Vegan?
Well, I have to give my editor credit for naming it. I really must. I combated it a little bit because I was wondering how I was going to go through the rest of my life saying virgin vegan. I said, you have to purse your lips and then you have to make a smile to say the two words. And I went on and on, but I have to say they know what they're doing. Gibbs Smith is the publisher. Well, my other book, Great Chefs Cook Vegan, was for, it was very high end. It was the most elite chefs in the country. And it's still one of the few books, if maybe the only book of that level in the vegan bookshelf right now. But what I really wanted to do was to go to the complete other end and have a book that was more like a primer, where it was a real starter. And all the books I saw in the market were really full of great information, and they really were for beginners. But the people I was talking to a lot, like my doorman here in New York City, a lot of people who just never buy a book that looks like it's an awful lot of chapters to read, and you have to put, like, the protein section has to, you have to go through maybe, you know, 15 pages or whatever. This one, my protein chapter is one page, the calcium page is one page, and the book is only the size of half of a copy paper, although it is hardcover. It, you know, people talk.
And it took a long time to put it together.
It did, because I did video talks to go with it. And I'm happy to say that up on YouTube right now is a video I did with you. In Lincoln, and that's perfect to sing because it was in front of Lincoln Center.
That's right, one of my favorite spots on earth.
Yes, it's a lot of creativity flowing through the air at Lincoln Center. And it's a book that answers those first questions that the first person, or that a person might first have when they're thinking, well, maybe I should think about this plant-based thing.
Well, what I like is, and something that I try to do, and I have to underline try because I know I get all wrapped up in whatever I'm talking about, but most people are very overwhelmed. They're overwhelmed with all the media sound bites. It's very confusing, and unless you're really following it every minute with all the studies that are going on, everything you hear can be very, very confusing. But a lot of it seeps in, and so people have a little bit of language about food, and they use that all the time, even though they don't know what they're talking about. And I don't think they need to know either. The thing about eating healthy and eating vegan, and I think those are synonymous, eating healthy and eating vegan. Well, you could eat vegan and not eat healthy, but okay.
That's true.
Eating healthy vegan.
You know, because sugar and
Coke and french
flour
fries
and all
are
that.
Vegan. Yeah. Boo. Yeah. But it's simple. You go to the produce section and you grab the fruits and vegetables, and it's easy to throw them together and make some delicious food. It's not hard to eat vegan.
Well, what I've done in the book is under soups and under salads, I did something called the anatomy of a salad. And then I did the anatomy of soup. And so what I've done is divided up into what the components are of each of those. And on page 60 is the anatomy of a soup. And so really, anybody could take that page, go to their refrigerator, and create their own recipe. Mm-hmm. Let us say, oh, I need something from this category, and I need something from this category and something from that. And before long, they have developed their soup. And it doesn't have to have anything to do with the recipe, actually, as long as they use vegetable broth or water instead of course, beef or chicken broth. And then a really neat thing to do, and this has been my favorite thing for a long time, and I'm just so surprised that I don't see it done more often, is that before I start my soup, I'll see, do I have any almonds, or do I have some cashews, or do I have some peanuts, raw, not roasted, and not salted either. Well, you could, but it's best not to. And I just grab a couple handfuls, put it in my blender, cover it with hot water, and just let it soak while I'm going on to do everything else. And when the soup is completely finished, I push the trigger of the blender, and I just let that whip until it's a cream. Add a little bit more water if you need to, if it looks like it's getting a little too thick, because it depends on what nut you're using. And then just pour it in the soup, and you have the most wonderful creamy. You've upped the protein. You've upped the flavor. And for years, I've been doing this. And people tell me, you're in my will for this soup. And I said, I swear I'll never be able to make it again, because I used just certain components, whatever was in my refrigerator, which vegetables in my refrigerator, what grain or bean was in my refrigerator, whatever.
We have a lot of soup recipes on the Responsible Eating and Living website. And like you said, we never make the same soup again. And I know that some people get frustrated because they might read a recipe and they say, well, I don't have Herbe de Provence in my cupboard, or I don't have a certain herb or whatever. And like you said, it's very flexible. You just need some basics and you really throw it together. But I guess for some people, when they're starting out, they need to follow.
Yes, and that's why it was, you know, I really did take an effort to write that soup I just described down. And then And then I can even be clever if I have peanuts and I have some sweet potatoes and I call it my African soup. But
I forgot you did.
But if I have cashews, and then I might use white potatoes because it then seems to be a little bit, not that you couldn't use sweet potatoes because superfood of the world, sweet potatoes, but every now and then I like to, you know, mix it up. And John Robbins does a great one in his book,
May All Be Fed.
And he allowed me to put that recipe in this book too. And it's a kind of a bisque and, white potatoes and cashews and lots of onions and parsley and leeks.
Well, we had a big holiday party at the end of the year, and then we left for California. So we put a bunch of stuff in the freezer. And when I got back, I took some of them out, and I wasn't sure what everything was. And one of it turned out to be a vegetable broth with a little cashew cream in it, because I don't think we wanted to put them in two separate containers. And we made a great soup out of it, just like what you said. And it was just, it wasn't even a lot of cashew cream. It was just rinsing out what was lingering in the container that we had used.
Yes, it makes all the flavor.
But just lovely. Just that tickle or that hint of cream really ties it all together. And it's important, especially when you have some vegetables that have fat-soluble nutrients, because I don't like using a lot of oil, but I like using fats that have fiber and are from whole foods, and they help those fat-soluble vitamins go down.
Yes. Yes. Well, I've done something similar with a veggie burger, because when people are starting out, that's the first thing
burger?
They think about
yep,
it, you know.
Right.
And so I have a section called Six Ways with a Veggie Burger, and the truth is you can make it very elegant as well with some gravy, kind of like I call it a little Salisbury steak with some mashed potatoes and some lovely vegetables and gravy. But I've also mentioned a stew, a taco, a burrito, of course, a regular burger. And I might say that you contributed a wonderful recipe for the book called a V-blat.
Ah, the V-blat.
The V-blat, which has avocado and vegan bacon on it, and
it's very good. I have to say that my partner Gary DeMattei helped me. We put that together, and he does quite a lot of cooking at home too. He does more of the comfort, satisfying man foods, and I kind of strive for the no salt, no sugar, no oil, light, really pure, clean stuff. And so we have a nice mix. But thank you for including that.
But that one is really good. I love it. And what is nice to for the starter is that this is really a replacement for the BLT.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the A part of BLT, BLAT, like we said, V is for vegan, BLAT, the A is for avocado. So
right. And I don't know what it is, but there's this big movement for bacon these days. A lot of people are just going
so
nuts
sad.
Over bacon. And it's a sad thing indeed because, it's not healthy, and pigs are super intelligent, sensitive beings. They're smarter than dogs, and yet we don't mind cramming them in unhealthy, odorful
metal crates.
Just horrible, cramped, filthy conditions, and they're very sensitive to smell, and they're living in this ammonia-filled environment because we don't do much with their urine and their excrement in the place that they're. And people don't connect that to bacon. And what bacon is just really salt and fat primarily.
Well, the truth of the matter is, I tell a lot of people, you know, what do you like about bacon? And they say, well, the taste. Well, what is the taste? Well, the taste is smoky.
Mm-hmm.
Aha! We can have a smoky taste without ever injuring or torturing a beautiful being. And you can even get bottles of smoke, liquid smoke, with a little drop or two. You can buy tempeh bacon. You can buy soy bacon and some of these other things.
There's a recipe for coconut bacon that looks amazing. It's I have yet to make, but it makes sense because coconut has all that fat. And just salt it and smoke it up and
right.
You got bacon.
Yeah, you can really have it. And lots of people say, oh, I tasted it. I tasted some of the vegan bacons and I don't like it. First of all, try all of them because people like different brands of anything, not just vegan products. But the other point is try it in something because then you're just going for the taste. So many times I found a friend who likes it in her sandwich. but she doesn't like just to eat it, you know, which is fine, you know, have it that way.
Right, perfectly fine. The other thing is, which you probably know, working in different food service environments over your life, is that people need to try a food numerous times before they like it. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize that because most of the time it happened when we were little kids and said, what's that? Or, I don't want that. And then just have a bite of it, just try it.
Yes.
And, you know, after five, six, seven, eight times, all of a sudden we're eating it.
Yes. Well, I've often told people, you know, there's a lot of brands of cornflakes, and I bet you don't like every one. And it's just one of those things where we get accustomed to things. I used to hate lima beans when I was young. And then I happened to get a lima bean in my mouth when I was a young adult. And I said, oh, my goodness, this is not what I remembered it tasting like. So it is.
Well, the other thing is when you move to a healthier diet and you eliminate certain things, your taste buds become far more sophisticated.
Yes.
And you can taste more things that you didn't taste before.
Yes, absolutely. One of the other questions I'm asked a lot, which I'm sure you are too, is that how do you order in a mainstream restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
Because so many people really have to eat out with their friends. You're not going to go to a vegan restaurant every time you go out to eat.
That's right.
And so I really gave suggestions, and some of it was offered to me by some little hints by a dear friend, Master Chef Eric Lauberg, who had been at O21 Club and a lot of wonderful places. And he's a consultant and really shakes up the mainstream world a little bit by telling them they have to have vegan options on the menu because vegans eat with meat eaters. And if you're not satisfying the vegan, you're going to lose that tabletop.
Right.
Forever.
That's right.
And so that's really good. But what I've done is that there's on page 16, there is a chart that a friend of mine created, Inger Lonbo, and she travels around the world as a vegan in lots of different languages. She wrote, she did a little chart of like a pig, a chicken, a fish, and then even the milk is coming out, and then there's milk in a can underneath, and then put little red X's over those things so that in any language the chef gets it, plus it creates a little humor in the thing so that they know, because lots of people, if you say I'm vegan, I don't eat any animal products, well, then their mind can kind of go blank. What you need to say immediately after that, what I prefer to eat is, and then mention, beans, rice, or any other kind of grain, vegetables, fruit, nuts, you know, then they can start to think about what to offer you.
Okay.
And so this can be printed out, too. There's a website for the book called virginvegan.com. And all of the extra recipes, we were over 100 pages. So I got very ambitious for a small book. So they're going to be on the site. It's in the process of being created right now. The website is actually up and the content is being filled. The video talks, even though, I interviewed Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Campbell and Dr. Clapper and a lot of very notable vegan chefs and other cookbook authors and nutritionists and athletes. I just would really, and I don't want to embarrass you on the air, Karen, but I really want to mention that your video is up right now. So you can go. You can go to YouTube and just write in Virgin Vegan and see there's about 8 up so far, but I have a whole lot more coming.
I'm going to post it on my site.
We've done almost 50 so far. But the reason I'm pointing yours out is that because of the challenge you had health-wise that was extremely serious for a young woman, and as you talk about sitting in the front of Lincoln Center, as we mentioned before, what you suggest to people to prevent chronic illnesses and those who have chronic illnesses is invaluable. I mean, it was one thing for me to talk to a lot of doctors and all that sort of thing, but to talk to somebody who's actually been through this, you really moved my heart.
Thank you.
And the inspiration.
Well, what's important about your book is it really gently, safely, easily opens the door. And once people kind of get over that, there is just mountains of information if they want it, if they need it.
Exactly.
And if they're having a health crisis, you know, something I learned, there's a bunch of vegans out there, and I might have been one of them, that felt like I was invulnerable. Nothing could get me because I was super vegan woman. And then, you know, oh, by the way, I got advanced ovarian cancer. And nobody gets out of this world alive. I like to say that a lot. And just because we're vegan doesn't mean we're not going to have issues. And there have been a number of vegans in the in the activist community that have unfortunately fallen or fallen ill. And what I've come up with is all of this great information that we've put out there. When you really put a focus on it, you can find ways to heal. And there are ways to just eat vegan and eat healthfully and happily. And then if you need to up it a notch to get to a place where you want to be, to get over something, you can do that too. And your book is like the beginning of the yellow brick road.
Yes.
Before
yes.
you make it to Oz.
That's what I wanted it to be, because I kept recommending so many books. Many of them are my friends, to people, and they just didn't get them. And then I thought, why is this? And they said, oh, I saw it. It was so much to read. And I thought, aha. Mm-hmm. And all of us have had talking points. We've all sat and talked with another friend about being vegan, and we know the questions they ask. We know how simple we have to make the answers when you're only, like, over dinner, perhaps.
Right.
And so that's what, after 36, almost, well, going on 37 years now being vegan, I really kind of have it down as to what, how to answer those questions. So that's all this was. And when I realized what I was talking to my doorman about was actually working, that he actually implemented it. And that then I realized. And when Gibb Smith called me to say, well, we had this idea of doing a beginner's book or whatever. And at first I thought it was strange because I did that elegant book. And so they said, we think that this would be really a good thing on the bookshelf. And because I had just been thinking about it, it was one of those synergy things going on. And so I said yes. But then all the other aspects started with the website and doing all the video talks. And, you know, so it's been very exciting.
Well, I can imagine it's challenging because there's more and more information out there about diet. We all think we know a lot. We really know very little. But to keep it very simple, there's just so much information. It's challenging.
Yeah, and once they start with this book, then they'll be ready for all those other books.
Okay. Well, we just have a few more minutes left. So what else can we point out in here? Now, you've got everything.
Do you want me to tell you about a few recipes?
Sure.
Well, I know that one of the biggest things is that people want to know, you know, how can you have pancakes? How can you have some of your favorite sweets? And how can you have a holiday meal? And there are books, separate books, on all of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once they see what's in this book, they'll be ready for all those other books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I'm trying to set people up to feel safe to stick their toe in. And then I want to be sure that all those other vegan books sell, too, because there's so much offerings
right.
out there now. I found my friend Frank Costigan telling me, oh, you know, I just had my soaked oats. And I said, what? She said, my soaked oats. Well, all she does the night before is put some oatmeal in a bowl and puts some soy milk on top of it and puts it in the refrigerator. And in the morning, if she wants to, she can sweeten it with some maple syrup. I love blackstrap molasses because it even has a lot of calcium in it. And throw in some nuts and fruit if you want. I thought it sounded terrible until I had it. I can't believe it. I mean, it's so hard for me to go to bed now before I have my oats soaking in the refrigerator.
Oh, that's funny.
Thank you, Fran Costigan.
I think the British do that, only with milk.
Oh, do they?
With cow's milk.
Yeah. And then I had a chef from Great Chefs Cook Vegan in Grand Rapids, Joseph Huber. He made an elaborate chocolate stuffed French toast with rolled in Rice Krispies. Well, the recipe goes on forever, but I simplified it and made it something so easy to do. And so that was another one. That would be like a Sunday brunch. And then for holiday, I have been making a cashew nut roast that it's a terrine, which means that it's in a loaf pan and you put half of the mixture and then you put a different mixture for the middle, not quite
you
as
have layers.
High layers, you know, and then another layer on top and you're done. Well, Rose Elliott, who's a great vegetarian cook, she's kind of the Martha Stewart of vegetarian cookbook authoring in England. And I got her book at Harrods a long time ago, and I'd made this for many, many years, and I bought any book she put out. Well, I decided, why don't I even see if I can contact her, that I can use this recipe that I've used every year for about 20 years. And now we're good email pals. So I feel like I have my rock star, you know, fancy vegan cook, where she's not vegan. She's vegetarian, but mostly vegan. But even that is on page 164, and I highly recommend it because it's so easy to do. And then I mentioned a sweet. There's some peanut butter cups that my friend Jane Belt, a home economist in London, Columbus, Ohio, gave me. And she truly makes these in a few minutes. And you can use a little cookie cutter to actually make them look like cups, or just cut them into squares. Let me tell you, I don't have time myself to do the little round cookie cutter. I just want to cut these in squares and get them out of the pan and eat them. So there's just a lot to offer is a variety. But I tried to choose things that were familiar that you could then substitute.
Right, like how easy it is to make gravy.
Oh, my goodness. A bouillon cube. And then throw in some cornstarch water.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people don't really don't do anything else.
Because what they don't realize is when they're using chicken stock, for example, what they're getting out of it mostly is salt.
Yeah, yes, yes. Now, bouillon cubes, I really like to mention it. One of my favorite ones is very salty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend not to use, I use a little bit more water than I'm supposed to, and I'm not sure that really changes it all that much, but they do put out bouillon cubes that have flavorings in it and even herbs without salt. So that's a good one to get. And then salt it to your liking. So don't be put off by, all bouillon cubes have too much salt. Get the one without salt.
Well, this is where it gets overwhelming again, because people go to a vegan diet or are curious about a vegan diet for lots of different reasons. So if you're curious, just because you're curious, then, you know, get this book, make all the recipes, and venture out and buy whatever other ones. But if you're having a health crisis, let's say, that's a different focus. And you might be thinking about eliminating sugar, salt, and oil.
Absolutely.
If you want to lose weight, that's a different focus. If you just don't want to kill animals, well, you know, you could be fine with Coke and French fries, although I don't recommend it. It really depends on what your focus is.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the thing is, with vegan food, you can have whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Oh, when I did Great Chefs Cook Vegan, and then I kept remembering one of the great chefs of the world actually is Von Gerichten. Jean-Georges Von Gerichten. For a moment, I forgot his first name. He said to me, "You mean I can use any plant food?" And I thought he was about to tell me, "Oh, but that's so limiting." When I realized his next breath was, "Oh, my goodness," his hands in the air, and he's either wide apart. And he said, "Where do I begin? It's such a vast area."
Yeah, vast.
And then he says, "You know, there's only a few animals, and we get tired of cooking the animals. There's only a few things to do with those animals. But when you tell me plant-based food..." So what I say to people is, you know, the standard American diet is what is limiting. Take a look at what you eat in a week and tell me, and then you repeat it week after week after week. Some people have almost the same thing every day, every day, every day. That's limiting.
I just did a crazy thing. It's not a crazy thing, but I like things organized. And one of the things about eating so that you're satisfied is to plan ahead and organize. Make sure you have the right ingredients, the right this and that. It can be really simple in one pot with a few cans, but, you know, if you want to follow a recipe, it's helpful to have a well-stocked kitchen. And just recently, I bought all these tins, and I invested in bulk organic herbs and spices. I've got everything now in this great cabinet, and it's really a lot of fun because you can use the same ingredients, like you said, the mirepoix, the carrots, onions, and celery, and put different herbs and spices, and you have completely different dishes every day just on how you season it.
Yes. Once you take the first step and then follow one of my recipes or anyone else's recipes, then you start to see what adjustments you could make. I mean, I'm surprised how lots of people, even in the beginning, they'll look at a recipe and they say, "Oh, I don't have this. Maybe I'll substitute less than so." Well, that's very nice. That's very bold for some. Others have to do it exactly the way the recipe says. But once you feel the confidence, then you start to see, "Oh, well, that's a vegetable. If it's corn, well, I could probably use lima beans too, or I could use edamame, you know, soybeans, or I could use whatever's on hand." And especially chili, my goodness, you don't have to use kidney beans. You can use black beans. You can use all kinds of other beans as well. And there is a recipe in there for black bean chili from my high school friends in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, Bob and Tom Boak, and they have a restaurant there. And so I've been trying to get them to include, you know, vegan options on their menus, because it really does bring in people who are not vegan.
Linda, thank you. Really, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, for writing this great book. And if you're still a virgin when it comes to food and haven't stepped out into the vegan world, this book is for you. You're definitely going to enjoy it, The Meatless Guide to Pleasing Your Palate. Vegan Virgin, virginvegan.com? Is that the website? Virginvegan.com. Okay, take the plunge. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we'll be right back with Charlene Spritnak. She's another Progressive Radio Network host, and we're going to be talking in just a few minutes. We'll be right back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Happy January 8th, 2013. And once again, I want to tell you also on my website, Responsible Eating and Living, I've recently put together my best real reads for 2012. Some of the books that I've read and the authors that I've interviewed, I've posted my five favorites. And not all of them were published in 2012. They just happened to be books that I read in 2012. So they're my best reads. And I recommend going to that link because some of those books were really outstanding. In fact, one of my favorites of the favorites was Peter Seidel's Invisible Walls, While We Ignore the Damage We Inflict on the Planet and Ourselves. I really learned a lot, and it was pretty inspiring. Okay, now I am going to bring on another responsible eating. No, I'm going to bring on another Progressive Radio Network host. Charlene Spritnak is going to join me in this half. She is the author of several books that proposed a map of the terrain and an interpretation of various emergent social movements and intellectual orientation. She has helped to create an eco-social frame of reference and vision, focusing particularly on modernity, its discontents, and the corrective efforts that are arising. And so much on her. She's written so many wonderful books. Her most recent one is Relational Reality, New Discoveries of Interrelatedness That Are Transforming the Modern World. We're going to talk a little bit about that now. Charlene, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you.
Wow. I was looking at the Relational Reality book and all the different topics that you covered, and it's, I don't know how you fit it all into one book. It's just, each one of those chapters is like books, several books.
That's true, because so much is happening right now about this, and it's, I put it in the context that in the last quarter of the previous century, there were a lot of bestsellers about discoveries in certain areas of science. First it was physics, and then chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And each of these books said, well, now that these discoveries have shown that the world isn't mechanistic, it's really dynamically interrelated, this is going to ripple out and change all our institutions and our systems of thinking. And we can look around and see that that didn't happen.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
Our institutions. And I think it's because those discoveries were too abstract for most people to relate to or pay much attention to. So I started thinking actually about 10 years ago, well, maybe I'm never going to see this shift into the relational understanding of the way the world works in my lifetime. But then I started noticing small articles in the newspaper starting around 2004, and there's a whole wave of new discoveries, which we're still in the thick of, and a lot of them are about physiology. They're also in other areas, and they're very concrete, very accessible, and they're changing, really changing all the institutions.
That's good news.
Yeah, well, so that's why there's so much in this book. And after this book went to press in 2011, of course, the story just kept breaking. So that's my radio program altogether now is actually tracking this relational shift. I have guests on from different areas where it's happening. And one of them, there was an article in The New Yorker, October 22nd, the whole microbiology, the whole field of microbiology is moving on to the relational model and off the mechanistic model. They always said, with the mechanistic lens, that if you have a virus or a bad bacteria in you, that makes you sick. But now they found out that's not at all how it works.
I was fascinated by that when I read it.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
And they say, you know, if we compare a well group of people and a sick group of people, say with Crohn's disease or diabetes or obesity or asthma, it's not that the sick group is lacking let me put it the other way. It's not that the well group is lacking a bad bacteria. Both groups may have a bad bacteria in their system, but the well group has the good bacteria that suppresses, it works in relationship and suppresses any damage the bad bacteria can do. So now they say, they literally say, we see now, it's not like a war. Medicine shouldn't be viewed as a war against pathogens. It should be like ecology, tending a forest or tending the fields. And all we need to do is design these probiotics with the right good bacteria that a person's missing, instead of going in there and carpet bombing the whole system with these broad spectrum antibiotics. So that's how extensive this shift is. It's really happening everywhere.
I like the concept of connecting the dots, that everything is related, and also the fact that things that we learn on a macroscopic scale are so similar to what's going on a microscopic scale. War on any level is not a good thing. War against our body, war against individuals, war against countries.
Right.
We need cooperation. We need to work together.
And also the fact that medicine trained all the young doctors to just sneer at nutrition. If anybody asked them, oh, should I be eating something because of this illness I have? I mean, you know, they would just glare at you like, you stupid peasant, what are you talking about? But now, I mean, just a few that I mentioned in the chapter on health and healthcare in relational reality, you know, they're finally really acknowledging that, that food has not only preventative powers but curative effects as well. So with all these different diseases now, they do say food is going to help you if you follow these certain diets. Like, for instance, that ketogenic diet, it's a 4-to-1 or a 3-to-1 ratio of fat to protein and carbohydrates. That's been found to control seizures in patients with epilepsy that's resistant to medication.
Right.
And anti-inflammation diets can control symptoms in a whole range of chronic diseases, midlife and old age. And then the low glycemic diet is now used to treat macular degeneration. And the low-fat weight loss has been found to reduce the chance that people with pre-diabetic syndrome will go ahead and develop type 2 diabetes. So, and mood disorders, especially involving sugar cravings, you know, they respond to dietary changes. So this is a big shift in mainstream medicine to look at food that way.
Well, you mentioned you don't know if you're going to see these changes in your lifetime, and
Now I do.
we see changes, but I'm often frustrated at how long it's taking.
That's right.
Because there's so much information out there, and even with the internet, it's really hard to get it so that people are convinced that it's credible, and it's going to take a long time. So we can go back in history and look at things that happened 100, 200 years ago and say, oh, okay, those things happened and that didn't take too long, but while we're living it, it seems like an eternity.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I wonder about in the book, too, because when we went on to the mechanistic model, after the scientific revolution, which was in place by the end of the 17th century, and then throughout the 18th century, it was called the new mechanical philosophy based on the new science, and it just changed all the institutions, the way schools were designed, even garden design in France, and the way the economy was theorized, everything like a machine. So I started thinking, well, if it took 100 years back then, shouldn't it go faster now because of all our high-speed communication? But, you know, we're past the 100-year mark of Einstein's first two papers that said, oh, the world is really not like we think. It's not a mechanistic clockwork. So it is going longer, but because of these new discoveries, it's really getting attention. And as I say, it's not only around the edges this time, it's smack dab in the middle of places like microbiology.
Now, you sound very upbeat and very positive, and I like to keep a very positive, upbeat feeling myself because, you know, we have a choice in life. We can be miserable or we can be happy, and it's a choice. It's a perspective, and it feels a lot better to feel good than to feel bad. But putting that aside, do you feel optimistic? Because with the economy the way it is and the choices that are being made in our government, it just seems like we just keep making one mistake after the next. I mean, so many things for the environment, let's say, could have happened around Jimmy Carter's that we
that
didn't
is so true
that we didn't choose to do, and we wouldn't be here today with all these problems. But we didn't make the right choices.
No, we didn't. And it sounds like you're much younger than I am, but people my age just are grinding our teeth, because even when a good thing happens, it's like, we tried 40 years ago to get that to happen. So I totally get that frustration. And it is very maddening with what's going on in Washington, because we can't get any of the votes for the public good as long as every vote is corrupt in the direction of needing to please the big donors for campaign contributions. You know, without campaign finance reform, every vote is corrupt, and we never get the votes for the public good.
Right.
Even saving the future generations from this horrible extreme weather that's picking up speed more and more every year, can't even get those kind of votes, like a carbon tax. So, yeah, it's very exasperating what's going on in Washington.
Now, this concept that you have, I haven't read any of your writing, and I'm definitely going to dive in very soon because it just all looks phenomenal. But this whole relational concept, just an example, I forget when it was, but we had a big movement to eliminate acid rain and to seal the ozone layer so that we didn't have a hole. And there was quite a focused effort in government and in technology to make improvements there. And I want to believe that we can do the same thing and relatively quickly if we all focused and got in line together.
Yeah, well, I look back at that and, you know, it was really a matter of those particles that were going up from aerosol cans and cooling systems, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess those were kind of small, although everybody had them in their houses. They were big by number, but not a huge part of the manufacturing sector. So they were able to be muscled and say, change the way you know, the heating, the cooling fluid that you're using, and replace, you know, pumps to replace the aerosols on all the household stuff. But there's just so much bigger players right now, meaning the whole oil and natural gas industry. I think it's just appalling that they're actually putting us on an export model now to wreck the country, so we not only would be self-sufficient, but beyond that, these people could just trash everything so they could make money exporting oil and natural gas with the fracking. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just too big. There's
it's,
just the big, the problems
really big,
are too
and,
big.
Until we get so the parties aren't desperate for those big campaign contributions, nothing, I think, is going to move. Although, you know, we have seen that when people really turn out at the polls, that gets their attention.
Right.
And money couldn't buy the votes they thought it could last time, because people, working people who are really going to be affected, just woke up and turned out at the polls. So, you know, we always have that if we can organize well enough.
What do you recommend people do on an individual level? Because for me, that's where I know we have control. We can do things personally ourselves. We don't need laws to change in order to do things in our own lives to make this planet a better place.
Well, we can, and that's important. But, you know, it's hand in hand with the structural changes. The lifestyle changes are very important. For one thing, you can connect your personal changes, things, choices that you're making with how it affects your community and your region and the country. And I just want to say, I wanted to fit this in somewhere.
Yeah,
but,
okay, now is the time.
Food, the title of your show, I think, is so great, because more and more I come around to that. It's all about food. And I was telling someone about the community-based economics model that's always been the Green Party's economic platform, and, you know, building up trade in a town, a city, a region, trading with the states around you. Not that there's anything evil in long-distance trade, but you're really vulnerable if you're basing everything on conditions in some distant place, and it's not ecological to be shipping everything around the world. So you're much more secure with keeping money circulating in your region. And we talked about this. I would give talks to both middle-class audiences and activist groups and inner city groups, and everybody would say, well, it sounds really interesting, but where is this working, Charlene?
Mm-hmm.
And the most I could do was talk about certain projects, places like Eureka, California had a number of community-based economy projects going on successfully, but not a whole town really given it their all. And so it didn't really get much traction until the farmers market movement just really took off and got spread all across the country in all kinds of neighborhoods, city and suburban and country. And then through the food markets, through the local farmers markets, people started getting what it means to support local businesses, and that if you buy from a local person, they're going to be putting the money into the community. They hire local accountants, local sign painters, local truck drivers, instead of sending it out to distant corporate headquarters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Also, some farmers markets have, you know, people come and sell things they've made that aren't food. They're almost like market days, the old European market days.
Yeah.
So really, the whole idea, the reason people kind of get community-based economics now, came out of the food market.
Right.
But we didn't guess that. We couldn't figure out that food was the catalyst.
That's right. You know, I appreciate you telling me that, because I personally do believe it's all about food, and that's why I talk about it all the time. But I'm looking at the chapters and the outline for your relational reality book, and I'm thinking I could probably link every one of these items listed here with food.
Uh-huh.
Because I think everything is related to food, at least through my rose-colored glasses. the farmer's market is really an amazing thing, and it's a great place to start. It's the community.
Yeah, and once you get the idea, if we had a green belt of farms around the town, you know, we wouldn't be vulnerable to what happens on the industrial food grid far away. So, yeah, I think it's really an idea that people are, you know, not associating with left or right or anything, just common sense.
Common sense, gosh. What a concept.
Yeah.
But it requires thinking, which I think is challenging for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, a big step is, as you know, getting the local institutions to buy from the local farms. So the public school cafeterias, the
right,
county,
the farm-to-table concept,
cafeteria, anything, any kind of taxpayer-funded operation that buys food should be buying, at least a certain percentage that could increase a bit every year from the local sources.
There's so much going on in the world, and I appreciate that we are now a global economy. We're connected with the entire world, and there's so many things going on everywhere, and many of us in the United States are far more privileged in terms of the stuff we have and the things we have access to than most other parts of the world. But that said, I really believe in getting involved in our own communities and strengthening them as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's such a, I won't say desperate. It's a very serious time. People need to work, you know, I say, as you were mentioning, the individual choices, how's this going to affect the community. They also need to put their time or effort, or at least send the check in to organizations like 350.org, who are really trying to organize public opinion for the global climate disruption. We really need to show up and be present on all levels right now.
Right. It's a hard time because a lot of people don't have that extra cash to give away.
Yeah.
But if you don't have extra cash, maybe you can find a way to volunteer.
Well, that's what 350 says. I mean, Bill McKibben did a tape, you know, for fundraising, and he said, even more than money, we need money, but even more than money, we need for you to turn out. You know, they're having a big demonstration, I think, in front of the White House in mid-February, President's Day Monday. And they want that also replicated in all the cities across the country. So there are lots of ways people can get involved and be counted. You know, that's the thing. The opposition, the coal and oil, needs to not be able to think, oh, we've got them all divided and they're apathetic and it's not a problem anymore. You know, they can't really fight when the numbers turn out.
Well, but is that really the best way? Is that the best way to make a difference? Because, you know, I know that I've participated in some rallies and there were thousands or hundreds of thousands and then nothing happened and it was frustrating and it keeps you from wanting to go out again. Letter writing, I know, when you send out an actual letter on a piece of paper with a stamp on it, seems to hold a lot of weight. But what do you think the most effective form is?
It has weight because they have a formula. They multiply it. Like if they say one constituent wrote a letter, that really means 22 hold this opinion in the district. You know, they have these formulas for how to interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
So it does definitely count more than your one letter. Well, you know, I definitely have felt that. And I come back to what Gandhi said when someone asked him in the middle of the independence struggle, which lasted decades in India, when they were trying to get the British Raj out of India. And someone said to him, what good could it do that I, one person, would do anything in this giant campaign? And Gandhi said, yes, you're absolutely right. Nothing you could do as an individual make the slightest bit of difference. But it is absolutely essential that you do it.
Right. Every drop in the bucket fills
the
bucket.
You don't know the effects, and we don't know where critical mass is.
That's right.
So it's just a matter of throwing your weight, you know, on the side of the angels. I mean, there's just important work to be done to stop the destruction.
Charlene, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. You can hear more about Charlene and her work every Thursday at 3 p.m. here on the Progressive Radio Network, or go to her website, charlenespretnak.com, and read all of her books. Thank you, Charlene.
Thank you.
Have a great week. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me, and have a delicious week.